Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio on location at the tip of the Mitt, as the locals call the northern part of Lower Michigan. We're in Indian River, Michigan at, we launch from Burt Lake State Park. Strong Tower Radio began a collaboration about 3 years ago with Professional Stewards of Natural Resources. Who am I talking about? I'm talking about the U.S. Forest Service, the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, and variety of Indian tribes wildlife divisions. We have explored wildfire preservation and control prevention. We've looked at forest diseases, oak wilt, and other topics. We've done a lot of articles on fish management, as well as also the Karner blue butterfly. And as far as fish, we've looked at walleye. We've looked at steelhead. A future article episode will be on whitefish, the collapse. In 25 years, the population has dropped 75%. Went from a high of around 4 million whitefish estimated in the Lake Great Lakes to 1 million in the lower Michigan and Huron lakes. We've done the Arctic grayling restoration, bringing back, replanting them. They're locally extinct. And then last year we did a program on the reclamation of the lake sturgeon. That was started out in June 6th of 2024, going on site riverside between 9 and midnight, catching little minnows, if you wish. The biologists use another term, but 3/4 inch to 1 inch minnows in drift nets in the little Manistee River, and then returning only 2 months later to see them being chipped and ready to be released into the little Manistee River. We're continuing that theme with lake sturgeon. We have an opportunity, a 10-year opportunity. Once every decade, the DNR surveys, a collaborative effort between the entities of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, the Indian tribes, the state of Michigan, and other entities to find out what is the health, what is the population of these lakes. This happens to be the year that Burt Lake is surveyed here in northern Michigan. And with me I have the president of Sturgeons for Tomorrow. His name is Jay Wardersky. And welcome to our program, Jay.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
You're really our host in the Sturgeons of Tomorrow. Tell our listeners what this organization is.
Sturgeon for Tomorrow formed in the late 90s, trying to assist DNR and any other management groups with rehabilitating the sturgeon population. Most of us began as fishermen that were basically being told that we would no longer be able to fish because the numbers were getting so low.
So that definitely put up a red flag.
Absolutely.
And you said there might be another solution.
Well, yeah, the group went down to Lansing to the NRC and said, look, we don't want this to end. What can we do to assist you to keep this going for us?
And truly that's what it has. It's been a collaborative effort of fishermen and people who want to see the sturgeon thrive.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So it's going to be a longer story, but stay tuned, folks. We're going to pause for a moment of prayer and then get deep into this story. Our great Heavenly Father, we just want to thank you for who you are and your grace. Adam and Eve were put here as stewards, and through the ages, we all have been stewards, and now it's our time. We're center stage, and it's under our curation. Lord, help us to be good stewards, whether it be a fish or wildlife, whether it be birds or moths or butterflies. Help us to be good stewards. Help us to learn, and we thank you for this opportunity. In Jesus' name, amen. Jay, where are we? We've talked about on Burt Lake, but what makes Burt Lake the epicenter of this Lake Sturgeon survey? And then you'll have to tell our listeners after that what a survey is.
Well, Burt Lake this year, it has been 10 years since they did the last survey. And they do these in a rotation, Black Lake, Mullet Lake, and Burt Lake. And obviously Black Lake was 2 years ago, last year was Mullet Lake, this year is Burt Lake. The DNR and the tribes and Michigan State University are all out here with gill nets trying to capture the sturgeon.
What is a gill net?
A gill net is a nylon net that sits down near the bottom of the lake with buoys to support the top part of it, weights to sink the bottom part, and the fish swim into it, and it kind of captures the fish by the gills.
Now, I saw a gill net for the first time this morning. We're here on the lake. We met with, it's such a wonderful collaborative effort. The Indian tribes, and there's multiple of them, have a vested interest in the fish population as well as other wildlife. And these gill nets, you want to think about, sometimes you've seen fences, some of them have larger that are put along to keep things in and out. Some of them are, many of them we think of as metal ones, they're wire and they're woven. You have chain length, which is very small and kind of diamond shape, but you also have other fences that are square or rectangular and different widths. You have rabbit fencing and you know, some are quarter by quarter and some are 1x4 and so on, but these are like 4x4 and different widths and stuff, and they're made of a unique material. What are they made out of?
Well, they're basically nylon, fishing line kind of is what they would be, pretty much the same thing. And they're using the 4-inch, the 6-inch, and the 8-inch mesh out here to capture these fish.
So, obvious reason why it's clear.
Well, and I think the biggest reason that it is it can be commercially manufactured.
Okay.
I mean, obviously natives have been using gill nets for hundreds of years, and they were not nylon to begin with, but because of the easy manufacturing, that's why it came to this.
And then also another advantage is, excuse me, editor, another advantage is that we're here during the middle of the day. It's a beautiful sunny day. Temperatures may get up 70, 75 degrees on this lake. It's very calm. It's a wonderful day to be on the lake. But fish can see things.
Correct.
And they can sometimes see nets, and sometimes they avoid nets because they can see them. So that actually maybe helps the chance of getting a higher catch rate of these fish. So, Jay, you're quite familiar with this. They're surveying the lake so they know how many fish are in the lake. Nobody really knows until you do this survey, and it still leaves a little bit of guesswork. It's a representative sample, correct?
Yes, they
have.
They're
not catching every fish.
That's correct. They have a formula for every fish they catch and release, how many recatches that they have with the same fish. Kind of gives them a group of numbers to work with to estimate.
So when you start catching the same fish over and over again, it's probably time to stop.
Yeah,
okay.
So let's talk about the story and talk about your organization, Sturgeon for Tomorrow, and you alluded to that. It's a wonder, as I've gathered in this discussion, it's a collaboration, and there's other hunting and fishing organizations. You think, oh, the hunters are only there to hunt, but there's a collaboration. There's a mutual interest that between. Do you mind explaining how you're helping, wanting the fish population to grow?
Well, I've always said that the biggest contributors to any conservation program are usually the people involved in the sport of, you know, pursuing those fish. And that's where we began. Basically, it was a bunch of fishermen that were kind of denied the, or about to be denied the access to fish these wonderful creatures. So we decided that something had to be done. And we stepped up and have been doing this now for about 26, 7 years. We put a sturgeon guard program together to guard the rivers so that when the fish go into spawn, that nobody's poaching them. Because there was most of the population, I believe, was actually lost to poachers, not the legal fishermen.
And, sure. And I think that point needs to be emphasized, not passed over quickly, is that we're trying to preserve the population of this fish, and we need to describe what this fish, because many people have never seen this fish, but we'll hold them in suspense for a moment here. But so the fishermen, there was a number of things, like all of our conservation, whether we talk about Arctic grayling, if we talk about whitefish, there's multiple factors. The whitefish might be actually on a different reason for the decline in population. Some of it is environmental issues, change of things. With the Arctic grayling is the way we logged things and it cleared the rivers, took away their habitats and took away the shade along the rivers. They like cold water, and when you take the trees away, that gets warms up the water, and you have silt that comes in. You see that with some of our trout, that becomes a problem. There's runoffs and, you know, clearing land and silt filling in, and it gets in their gills, they can't breathe, and there's just a variety of things that happen. But it's interesting what you're saying about poaching, that the Sturgeon for Tomorrow comes alongside, and talk about this poaching. What was the devastating and effect of poaching? You believe to be taking more in poaching, but when you take them in spawning, it has a multiplier effect, I guess, that it is more devastating than catching a single fish. You're taking out a generation.
Correct. Yeah, that's the biggest problem. And not only was it the poachers, because some of the things you described about the grayling, a lot of that has come into play with the sturgeon. A lot of their spawning habitat has been taken away through deforestation, erosion into the river, the dams put into place. You know, the fish can't access the great places that they used to spawn. So that has had a lot to do with it also.
And flesh that out just a little bit.
Well, the biggest thing with the poaching is the fish, when they're up on their spawning run, which is usually late April till mid-June, they're there to spawn. And they're in the shallow waters. They have no concern other than to go up the rivers to spawn.
They're just easy targets.
They're just so easy to take out of the water at that point.
Yep. And they're also getting ready to spawn, which is planting the next generation.
And many generations. I mean, these fish live to be, you know, 100 years old or so.
Speaking about that, not every fish lives to be 100 years old.
No, they don't. No, they don't.
So what makes a sturgeon so unique? And describe what a sturgeon looks like. They don't look like your normal perch or your normal bass or even They don't even look like a bass.
To me, a lot of people would say, well, they kind of look like a catfish. I think catfish look more like the sturgeon. I think are a much more beautiful fish. I really do. I mean, a lot of people tell you they're the ugliest thing they ever saw, but you know, I've grown up my whole life pursuing sturgeon and being around them, and they're just a fabulous, wonderful creature. They get to be up to like 8 feet long. They're primarily bottom feeders off the bottom of the lake. They eat crayfish and dead fish and things like that. They got the four barbels up on the front of their chin.
What is a barbel?
It's like a whisker that senses senses food as they go along the bottom.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, you've got a sturgeon on your shirt, a graphic of it. Makes me think of kind of an alligator or crocodile a little bit.
Well, they could, but they have absolutely no teeth.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
So that makes them a lot safer to be around.
And probably better than a muskie or some of the big game fish.
Right, right.
And what's interesting, they have kind of a pointed, narrow head, where catfish has a bolder, more rounded head,
right,
and such. So they also have bumps or scales. They have kind of a pointed back, dorsal.
They're called scutes. And the reason those are on the fish is basically protection. They are, once they get to be about 5 or 6 inches long, they are pretty much no longer a meal for a predator. Those little sharp scutes are pretty tough for predators.
Their protection, their armor.
Yes, and the older they get, the less those scutes are there. Because the body fat, meat, and stuff gets more around them, but they also wear them off, you know, through the time, because they don't need them. Once they reach a 3, 4, 5 foot, there's nothing going to touch them. So they're, you know, that's just one of their protective things.
They are. What color are they?
You know, and a lot of times that depends on the water they're in.
Really?
In this beautiful clear water here, I'd like to tell you that they are almost a bright silver.
Really?
Yep. And in darker water, they will be more of a gray to black. I mean, we fish in Wisconsin, and their fish over there in Lake Winnebago, because that water's so dark and tainted, their fish are almost they're such a dark gray, they're almost black.
So where do they live? They don't live where all the fish live.
Well, I guess they do to some degree. They live in any waters that were connected to the Great Lakes is where our strain of sturgeon are from. There's several different types, but they live in different categories of depth. I mean, there was a young lady did a survey back in the 80s out on Black Lake where it actually had the transducers in them to follow them. And they did find those fish to be anywhere from 2 to 3 feet down to 50 feet of water.
Wow, wow. Now they are in the Great Lakes, but they also are in lakes, and they also are in rivers. Which lakes and which rivers might they be in?
Anything connected to the Great Lakes basically has a population or remnant population of sturgeon. I mean, some may be totally gone from those places, but like Mullet Lake, Burt Lake, Black Lake, these are all connected through the Sheboygan River into Lake Huron. Down in the Manistee River, I know they've got fish in there. These fish, you know, the Saginaw Bay, we've been putting some fish in there, but the St. Clair River has a very good natural population that's being taken care of very well.
Now, as far as the preservation of these fish, you talked about native or natural fish, and then what has humans and these various stewards, be the DNR or the Indian tribes, what have they contributed and how do they do this?
Well, I would say that mostly what has happened is through the last, we'll say 25 years, has been really a big push. They go out and collect the larvae, and they raise them in hatcheries until they get to that 5-6 inch range, where then they're no longer such a delicacy for the predators. Because when they're really small like that, crayfish, bass, I mean, just about anything eats them, you know, and once they get to that 5 to 6 inch range, they're pretty much no longer a predator's feast.
Exactly, and that really ties into last year when we did the recordings and we collected the 3/4 inch minnows. And then we came back just the week before Labor Day, and they were 5 or 6. So they get them through that stage, and then they release them. And so now we're looking to see where how good the work has been done here on the Burt Lake and such. So this is a wonderful combination. Now, you to do, you not only help, how do you help with the poaching situation? What do the citizens do to help with that poaching?
Well, we put on what we call a sturgeon guard every spring. We start about the 20th of April. We run it till about the middle of June.
Sounds like a little militia.
It kind of is, you know, but it has become more of a camaraderie community out there because we have been doing it so long that the poaching is really almost non-existent in the area where we have been for so long.
If somebody's watching, and it really, let me throw you a softball for you, a home run pitch, but what's so bad about poaching?
You know, 30 years ago, I probably would have told you it was not really a big deal because we really didn't understand what was going on with the population when it happened. I mean, I won't deny that probably some of my ancestry may have been involved in a little bit of that. It's just that now that
up and become more responsible.
Now that we understand what it has done to the population, absolutely, it needed to be stopped. Yeah, and our biggest accomplishment through the years has been education. You know, our presence out there has really prevented
realize
it.
What you're doing.
Exactly, and we have educated a lot of people that, you know, used to be part of that poaching problem. I mean, some of these youngsters are coming up, and just like me, I'm, you know, running the Sturgeon for Tomorrow program here. We've got some of these guys that were part of the problem in their family, and they're off doing exactly what these people are out here doing today. They're working for the DNR, trying to save the sturgeon.
They're on the right side of the fence.
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Very good. So you have the sturgeon guard is really to protect the sturgeons at their most vulnerable side, just eyes and ears, and say, hey, guys, that's not the way we play around here.
Right.
Now, let's talk about the sturgeon season. You have said something that just caught my ear. It's one of the shortest fishing seasons ever. Explain that in detail.
You know, we started out with the short season because our numbers that we can take are so restricted. We started out in 2000 with a lottery system where they would only allow 25 people on a lake. We were allowed 5 fish. Sometimes that would drag out for the 4 or 5 days.
Here's the thing is going back to the introduction, there was the possibility of no season at all.
Correct.
And the point is once you stop something, it takes a while, just like COVID. Once you set it, shut everything down, it takes a few years to bring everything back online, and people are a little slow to doing it. You were basically, your organization was saying, hey, let's not completely stop it. Let's just take it to a sustainable low level, and when it comes back, it will be easier to start doing this again. So I stopped you for a moment, but you go back to that. You said, okay, we're only going to take so many fish. We're going to reduce the poaching, and now we're going to do responsible fishing. So pick up the story there.
Well, like I said, we had a lottery system. We'd allow 25 people to fish. The limit was 5 fish. That could last for 3, 4, 5 days.
That made it a premium to be one of those 25 people. It got to be fun.
It did, and the I mean, lotteries have created more interest in many things. You know, that there used to be less bear hunters, there used to be less, you know, sturgeon fishermen, when we could do it all the time. The season was at one time a month long, you know, and everybody could take a fish. Now we're limited to 5 total. Well, then we were. Now we're all the way up to 7 for us and 7 for the natives. But I don't remember the exact year, but somewhere in the late teens, we opened it up to anybody that wanted to fish with a legal license. This last year, we had about 500 people out on the ice pursuing sturgeon. 7 total for the entire state. So the season lasted all of 17 minutes.
17 minutes. You bet. If you came late, it was too bad.
Exactly. Like 17 minutes late.
Wow. And you said that this has done some interesting things. Is it's cost... whoever heard sturgeon? There are sturgeons in Europe and in around the world, but you said that literally the world has beat its feet to the shortest contest in the whole world, and you've had chances to interview people in different places. Tell our audience about the interest that's been generated from the media.
Well, we've had, you know, I had to give some information out to a place over in the Netherlands and Finland and you know, Boston, New York, all over. We actually had people come to our season that were from Oklahoma, Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana. They come from all over to be part of the 17-minute season.
All right. Well, Jay, we're going to pause for a moment, and we're going to see what the fishers are, what the our stewards are doing for us, the professional stewards, and we'll pull up beside their boat, and hopefully we'll find some fish today.
Sounds good. Let's go do it.
Let's do it. I'm here with Emily Martin. She's a biologist for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Mm-hmm. Welcome to Strong Tower Radio on location.
Thank you.
Now, we've heard that we're here at Burt Lake, and the survey so far is underwhelming.
Yes.
So what is, tell us, are you concerned?
I wouldn't say that based on this survey I'm concerned. I think, you know, these surveys can be difficult to do. Sturgeon are not the easiest fish to target in that. You know, a couple years ago when we did a survey in Black Lake, we got a lot of sturgeon, but we know Black Lake is a higher density system. There's a lot more fish in Black Lake than we anticipate to see in Mullet and Burt Lake, and so I'm not concerned necessarily about the results. You know, I think there has been a lot of stocking in the past, and we've done other surveys where we caught younger fish. We're not seeing as many younger fish this time, so doesn't necessarily mean that the population's declining or that stocking's not working. It could be that fish are just hanging out in areas where we're not netting.
And you really, I've seen the map of all the places that you're setting your nets, but you mentioned there's 10 boats, there's 2 locations per boat, so you're only 20. And what is the size? Describe the size of this lake. You're only setting 10 nets.
Yes, so we're setting 10 nets a day. We have 5 crews. They're setting 2 sites a boat. And so each crew at each site is setting a 1,200-foot net. And Burt Lake is over 10,000 acres. So, I mean, 10 sites in a day in a lake that size, I mean, you know, it's not a ton of coverage. It's really good coverage compared to some other survey work we do. This is a pretty intensive effort, but... still, I mean, there's a lot of lake bottom that we're not sampling, so it's possible that fish are just, you know, in different areas.
Now, talk about, there's, if I could put it, there's places that are off bounds. You cannot put the nets everywhere. You mentioned about oxygenation. You've talked with me about it, but talk to our listeners. How important is oxygen, and you don't want to stress the fish? Explain that to our listeners.
Yeah. So dissolved oxygen levels are pretty critical for all fish, but especially for lake sturgeon. They're not going to want to hang out in water where dissolved oxygen is low, because that's stressful for them. So anything below the units we would use is 6 milligrams per liter. Anything below that is potentially going to be kind of stressful for them. And so we want to try to avoid areas, deep areas, where those levels might be lower, so that we're not, fish aren't being held in a net in those lower oxygen levels and stress, and experiencing stress and, because of that.
And high dissolved oxygen is better.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. To a point. But in a natural environment like this, like you shouldn't have any issues with oxygen levels being too high. So in an artificial environment you could, but yeah. So higher is better in a lake like this.
What thoughts would you share with our audience that may have never seen a sturgeon before? Help them get oriented to the sturgeon.
Yeah, so sturgeon they're interesting. They're a lot different than many other fish that, you know, we see in our work and that most people see kind of day to day. They look kind of prehistoric. They have bony scutes along their backs and sides. Especially adults are much bigger than most fish that people are gonna see on a daily basis or on average. I mean, we've seen fish out here that are 70, 71 inches long.
That would be a fun catch.
Yeah. Yeah. So pretty big fish. And they feed, you know, on the bottom. They have kind of this suction mouth that kind of moves in and out as they're feeding. And so they just look a lot different, you know, than fish that many people are kind of familiar with. And I think that makes them really interesting to people.
How important is this if we lose a fish species? What is the ramification?
Yeah, so sturgeon are, you know, a native fish. They're an important part of these native ecosystems and the biodiversity. And, you know, in DNR, we value that native biodiversity. And so
Try not to lose it.
Yeah, we don't want to lose that.
Not on our watch.
No. And, you know, sturgeon are a charismatic fish, and they're valuable just in terms of, you know, they feed on the bottom. They're a benthivore. They eat all sorts of things off the bottom. And they're kind of, you know, they're a little bit more sensitive of a species, so they can be an indicator species for things like habitat degradation and poor water quality, too. So, you know, they're valuable in that sense, as well as their value culturally to tribal people in Michigan. So there's a cultural value there too, a historic cultural value.
Emily, thank you so much, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.
And thank the rest of the DNR crew. You're sitting here in a boat with five of you there.
Yep.
And we're going to interview a few of the other people too. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Happy to do it.
Braden Sprick. Braden, you are a college student.
Correct. Yeah, just finished my third year at Michigan State University. Going back to my fourth and most likely final. We'll see how physics goes.
You know, that is an eliminator for some people.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what are you doing out here on a boat in the middle of Burt Lake in the summer?
Yeah, living the life, apparently. So for the most part, this is not my daily routine. My current job at the Department of Natural Resources is a creel clerk. That's kind of the slang term, but basically what it is we talk to anglers. We go around, talk to them, figure out catch rates, figure out population levels. And creel clerks mostly focus on game fish species in the Great Lakes, so all the salmon species, lake trout, steelhead, all the main ones for sure. And today, I just was fortunate enough to hop on with the crew out here to do a sturgeon survey. I heard word that it was going on, and I had to take that opportunity.
Once in a decade, you got to do it.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure.
Tell us about your job. I mean, I didn't know about your job until this morning, and we met at the boat launch this morning. Where does you're talking to? You have a wonderful job. You get to talk about fish. You get to hear fish stories all day long.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So what is the value to your employer, which happens to be the Department of Natural Resource, and what is the value to the public with the information you gather?
Yeah, so to the DNR, creel clerks are a pretty crucial part for determining game fish population levels. It's pretty key, especially for salmon species. I believe it's one of the very only resources they use to really determine those levels. And we also just determine fishing activity as a whole, so pretty important.
Eric Christian.
Yeah, my name's Eric Christman. I'm a technician supervisor for the Tribal Coordination Unit out of the Charlevoix office. So Braden's responsibility and kind of our Great Lakes Creel program is to determine angling effort in most of our Great Lakes ports, as well as recreational harvest of those game species. So that's kind of the main duty of our creel program in the Great Lakes. So, is to get an idea of angler effort and recreational fishing harvest of those species.
So it's basically the feedback to the department is saying, do we need to pay attention to something?
Yep.
What's doing good and what's not?
Yep.
And such. Very good. Eric, is there anything else that from your, what's your day job? You're a coordinator between the tribes. Explain that relationship between the tribes and the DNR.
Sure. So what we do is, co-manage a lot of our species that we, that are of interest to the tribes. So most of those are whitefish in the Great Lakes and walleye and sturgeon in our inland lakes. So we do a lot of walleye population work on our lakes in the treaty area, 1836 and the western end of the UP, the 1842 treaty area. So we kind of share work plans with the tribes, kind of come up with priorities for the year, and then some surveys we might work together like we are today. So we have tribal agencies out on the lake as part of the crew, along with Michigan DNR crews. Or sometimes we just might split up those priority lakes and each kind of do our own unique surveys and then share data at the end of the year.
Eric, would you mind telling us about right now where you've set the nets, you allow fish to swim through them and to be caught in them. We're looking at sturgeon. What's going to happen next? We're just waiting for a period of time to go check the nets. Tell us what will happen.
Yeah, so we're using large mesh gill nets today for sturgeon. So, we're using 10-inch, 8-inch, and 6-inch mesh gill nets, which are very size selective for large fish. So pretty much the only fish we're going to see are sturgeon today. And we're going to check these nets every hour just to ensure the condition is good of the fish we catch so they're able to be released. We're going to, we got two nets set in two locations, and every hour we're going to check them. When we catch fish, it takes us, we put them in a tub of water. We're pumping fresh water on those fish in the tub constantly. It takes about 5 to 10 minutes to work up a fish before we release it.
So we've got, we're right here in the, it's just an agricultural watering tray for cows or horses or such. It's about 2 feet deep and about 5-6 feet long. Well, have you ever had a fish that didn't fit in it?
We caught a few on this survey this year that were pretty close.
Okay.
We caught a couple fish in the 70-inch category, which kind of max out the tub. So
I'm looking forward to seeing some of those fish. So I will let you get back to work, and we'll be seeing, talking to you, hopefully, at least observing what takes place once you catch a fish.
All right, thank you.
Thanks so much, Eric. Emily, we've had early success. I mean, when we were down on the North Muskegon River, Manistee River, we went all night for 3 hours catching one minnow. We've already equaled our number. What do you have in the tank here?
All right, so we have a sturgeon here who's 67 and a half inches long.
And that's the biggest fish I've ever caught.
Yeah.
And I didn't even catch it. What was that net, the spacing of the...
So we caught this fish in our 10-inch mesh.
10-inch mesh.
Yep, in our 10-inch mesh net. So, this is one of the bigger fish that we've seen during the survey. And it's a very healthy fish. So the girth on this fish is 31 inches. And it's just a very healthy, but probably pretty old fish. And it did already have a pit tag that was in sequence with the tags that we're using this week. So we know that it was probably tagged during our our survey in 2022, 3 years ago.
It, you know, the coloring looks like a dolphin coloring, kind of a gray, very smooth. And we talked about the scutes. It's just almost flush across there. It's breathing in and out through its gills. How do you measure it, not only the length, but the girth?
Yeah, so we take the girth behind these front pectoral fins, kind of at the widest part of the fish, and that gives us an idea of kind of health and condition of the fish as it kind of compares to its length. So a fish like this at this size, a 31-inch girth is indicative of a pretty healthy fish.
Now, this is in the gill nets. We set the nets just an hour ago. You picked this one up already. You were pretty excited about this.
Yes. Yeah, we were pretty excited to see one right off the bat this morning. So, and she was, you know, we got her in the tub quickly and got her out of the net. She was in the net good, but came out pretty easy. And she looks really, really good. She's breathing good and... you know, just looks good.
Do you need to do anything else with her, or is she?
She is good to go, actually. Would we? What?
You take another fin?
We already took it.
Floy tagging her down?
Oh. So the only other thing other than, since she was already tagged, we don't need to tag her today. We took length and girth, and then we also take a dorsal fin clip as a tissue sample for genetics.
And she's already had this done before, so it's a benchmark before to see if she's still at that same trajectory.
Yes. So we'll be able to look back at tag data at the size that she was when she was handled and tagged, and then we'll be able to see how much she's grown in that amount of time, and that can kind of give us an idea of the growth rate of this particular fish. And then if you handle enough fish that are already tagged, it can give you an idea of growth in the lake. So
how old do you think she is?
It's hard to guess.
You never ask a woman her age, right?
yeah. So I would say for sure a fish this size is over 50 years old. At this size, we actually can't reliably age them. We can't take any sort of structure from this fish that will allow us to get an age estimate like we could with others.
She's about the same class.
Maybe. So, I would say at least 50, but it can be hard to say with a fish this size.
How big is that front dorsal? What measurement would you call it?
Do you want me to...
These like, front pec fins?
Yeah.
We can measure real quick if you want and see. We were talking about that, though, that her... these pec fins right here are the size of one of the guys in the crew of his hand.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, pretty big fins.
And it's wider than the tank.
Yep.
Wow. 23 inches.
So it's 2 feet across when they look like that jet airplane.
Yeah.
And they're very far forward. It's about a foot or maybe 16 inches from the front of the fish, the nose and such. Well, I'll let you guys get back to work if they're... So we're hoping this is just a good indicator for the rest of the day.
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully it's a good start, so.
Thank you, Emily.
Thank you.
I'm talking with Jay, the president of Sturgeon for Tomorrow. He and I are about out here. He's been fishing for years. Just because of probably the data, they've had these pet tags, which is just a tracking tag that they can go back to a database and tell them what they've seen them before and the recognition. But you're saying that they used to take the sample off that, like rings the tree, and they thought it had an idea of their age. But as talking to Emily, sounds like after they get to a certain age, that isn't as reliable.
Correct. Yeah, that's something that they've just really in the last 8-10 years they've kind of developed that opinion. These fish can be much older than they were originally estimating them to be.
It's interesting that we're always learning, aren't we?
Exactly. And that's the one thing that has happened with the Black River and the Black River hatchery, which is where all these planted fish come from.
Where is the Black River? That's near here?
Well, Black River is probably about 20 miles from here.
Okay, in the tip of the mid again.
is connecting waters with the Sheboygan River. Black River dumps into that, and Black Lake is up the other stream. So it actually adjoins right into the Sheboygan River to dump back out to Lake Huron.
And it's just strange is that it seems like we're as close to Lake Michigan as Lake Huron, but is there across the waterway across the top of the Met, or is that another channel that goes
Well,
across?
Technically, they will tell you that, and I don't know how feasible it is to run a boat all the way across there now, but if you come through the Sheboygan River into Mullet Lake, through Burt Lake, into Crooked Lake, into Pickerel Lake, there is access all the way up to Lake Michigan. I've never made that trip, and I don't know that it's actually boatable all the way.
Okay. So. Now, we talked at the beginning of the program that fishing has been in your formative years, and tell our listeners a little bit of your connection with the sturgeon.
Sturgeon season in Michigan opened up, I believe it was 1948, possibly 1947. My father, my grandfather, my great uncles were all part of that when it opened up. So when I was born, it didn't take me long to be in a fish ante, I can tell you that.
Now, what I'm gathering is this is not a warm weather sport.
Absolutely not. Although we have through the years made it much better. We've got all insulated, heated fish antes, and you know, so life isn't so terrible once you get there.
Well, very good. Now, what was your thoughts? This is the first time you've been out on the survey, and what was your thought when you saw those that boat? You read their actions there. There's five of them out on a boat that's about 18 feet long. I was still trying to take in this experience, and you noticed their actions like they were getting ready to pull up a fish.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, I haven't watched these guys actually do this survey, although I probably should have done it for many times through the years. But I have been in the realm of where the natives run gill nets, you know, so it's kind of along the same thing. But this is much more pronounced because of the size of these fish. You know that when they're pulling up an empty net, there isn't much weight. And when they pull up a fish like that, then I'm going to tell you at 67 inches, it's probably getting about 100 pounds, between 90 and 100 pounds. So that's pretty big fish.
And everybody's on board, and everybody's, they're all on the same side of the boat.
Right, right, exactly.
Well, they're already, they're halfway through the first net, the first look at the net. They're moving along at, they're moving at about 10 feet a minute or something. They're explain how they're at the buoy. There's a orange buoy in the middle. At the end, they have kind of looks like a bobber on the far ends. Explain how they're looking at the net and how they pick up things.
Basically, what they do here is they start at one end, and they call that a lead down to the net coming off of the outside flag.
It's a rope.
It's a rope. Basically, you pull it up. They pull up the net where they can get it up high enough off the bottom to know whether there's a fish in there, because they'll feel the weight instantly.
They're lifting it.
They lift it up so it comes right up to the surface, but they don't take it out of the water unless they have a fish, because there's no need to. I mean, they can tell if there's a fish in it when they get it up there.
So they're in the middle of the boat, they're pulling it, they're going down the net to the part that they haven't looked at. It actually, they pull it up to the above the water, and like you say, there's some tension or there's a little weight on it. So well, let's stay tuned and see if there's any more fish.
All right, well, they're about done with this one, and then we'll head over to the second one they set and try that.
And then we're also going to take a look at some of the other. We're very pleased. This was probably not as fertile a ground, or most had a lower prospect. Some of the other ones had a better, the other teams on the lake, but this might be a really good day.
Well, previous expectations were higher at other places because they did have some more success. But sturgeon will move all around this lake on any given day, the whole length and back, so you never know.
Well, I was just thinking, as trying to think of an analogy, of this multiple acres of water surface here, and it's just a small, they're only putting nets in such a small part. It's It's just interesting. Well, stay tuned and we'll continue this and see. We're just as excited as our listeners are to find out what happens today.
Absolutely.
This is real time.
It is. It's wonderful.
Jay, they've just finished the first net, and what are they doing now?
Going to head over to that second net to pull that one, and hopefully there'll be a few more fish than the one, but hey, we'll take one if it's all we get to see, so let's go over there and join them and watch them.
Well, put on the gas. Jay, something good happened here.
Yeah, they got a fish out of the first half of this net. They've worked it up. They're going to release it, and then they'll come back and do the other half of the net.
It was something I never thought about, but they need to release it far enough away so the fish has got caught once, it doesn't need to be caught twice.
Well, you know, a recapture is not a bad thing, but you don't want it to happen because you put it back in the net.
Yeah, so he's gone maybe 100 yards away, and I guess that's what they're doing right at this time. Tell us what you observed from that fish. We really appreciate the relationship with the DNR. They've been so accommodating. It's just amazing.
Yeah, we've had that relationship for, you know, over 20 years for sure. You know, I mean, absolutely anything we need to know or need to work with them for, they're always, you know, come on out, help us out, do what you want to do, see what you want to see, and they're just wonderful people to work with.
It's so interesting. We've caught two fish, they've caught two fish, and once they get done with their net, the fish is secured, they bring them show and tell, bring them up to us, and so that we could do an interview with them, and they'll probably talk to us about this one. It looks a little shorter, but nobody's going to complain about a 60-inch fish.
No, a 5-footer is a pretty good fish.
That's right. It's just been wonderful. We got some good shots. Hopefully we'll get those put on our Facebook page. They held them up, took two guys to hold up that fish. Tell our listeners a little bit, if you catch fish, traditionally people with big game fish, they pick them up and hold them by the gills. What's wrong with that?
Well, technically, when you pick a fish up by the gills, you're basically sticking your hands right into their lungs, into their breathing apparatus, and that will be very damaging to them. You know, I know we have a lot of fishing places in the state of Michigan where people get to catch pike and muskie and things like that, and that's absolutely the biggest no-no there is. Don't ever stick your hands in their gills. Don't ever hold them up head first, you know, head high. Those are things we try to teach everybody. Proper handling will save a lot of fish's lives.
So basically, when you hold a fish, you need to hold them horizontally.
Exactly.
And you say, well, this fish is slippery. What countermeasures can be done to say, well, how do you hold on the fish for that trophy picture?
Well, you know, some people will take a small rag or a towel or something like that, and then there's gloves that have the little grippers on them, or, you know, like latex gloves kind of stop that thing from slipping so much. So there's ways to control it. I mean, but if you get that 5-foot fish and it decides it's going to have an attitude, it might be hard to hang on to no matter what.
Thank you, Jay. We're waiting for some reports here, and after we see the second half of the second net, we're 3/4 through with this crew. We may visit them later in the day because they're on our way back to the boat launch. We're going to go up and visit some other fishermen, researchers, and see what they have to say. Each one has a different piece of the pie.
Exactly. Perfect. Yep.
Okay. Thanks so much, Jay.
Yep.
We have with us Dylan Jones. He is with the Little Traverse Band of
Ottawa Indians.
Ottawa, yep. Indians. Thank you for your service.
Yeah, happy to do my part to help out.
It's good to see you here. I've talked to you on the phone, but to see you out in the on the lake here. Whereabouts are we on this lake? This is a 10,000 square
acres, I believe. Yeah.
Lake.
Yeah, we're just about half mile northeast of Colonial Point. So we're kind of in the northwest section of Burt Lake, kind of around halfway up the lake.
Yes, and tell our listeners the vested interest that the tribe has in the sturgeon.
Yeah, so tribe has long had an interest in lake sturgeon, which the tribe calls Neme, N-M-E apostrophe. It is a historic clan animal for members of the tribe. The sturgeon clan is known for possessing a lot of wisdom. The sturgeon itself is a long-lived fish, grows to be, you know, over 100 years old. And so it's reflected in that cultural value of, you know, having a lot of knowledge, being able to impart that to younger generations. The sturgeon clan is a clan that's turned to when tribal members or the tribe itself needs wisdom or guidance on a certain issue. And they were traditionally some of the leaders. It's a leadership clan of the tribe.
Now, how long has the tribe been actively involved in the preservation of sturgeon?
So the first department that was formed when the tribe was federally recognized was our Natural Resource Department.
The highest priority.
It is and was the highest priority for the Little Traverse Bay bands of Ottawa Indians.
To preserve the wildlife.
Yep. To preserve the wildlife, the Anishinaabeg peoples have a 7-generation framework for conservation, where everything they do is to preserve a resource for the 7 generations that follow.
Now, what has the tribe done? The sturgeon has been important, but what other wildlife species have they focused on?
It really runs the gamut. I mean, currently, even just this month, we're working on piping plover projects out on the Beaver Island Archipelago. We work with wood turtles, walleye. We're doing a fish contaminant survey on lakes around the tip of the Mitt. So, you know, it really runs the gamut from elk to bluegill. You know, any fish, any species that's native to the area is something that we take care of.
Stewardship.
Yeah, yep.
What if our general public would like to know more about the Little Traverse Bay of band of Ottawa Indians of what would how could they interface or find out the good work that you're
We do have a Facebook page online. It's Little Traverse Bay Bands of Ottawa Indians. I believe we even have one for our Natural Resource Department specifically, so it would be under Little Traverse Bay Bands of Ottawa Indians Natural Resource Department, NRD. Facebook's a great way to reach out to us. We have a website as well. The tribe does, and forgive me, I don't know the link off the top of my head.
We kind of caught you off your game here, being in the middle of the lake.
Exactly. I'm not at my desk and can't just look it up really quick while we're interviewing. But you know, my information should be available on the website as well. I'm the inland fisheries biologist for the tribe, and so I'm happy to answer people's questions. Yeah, feel free to reach out to my email, or my phone number should also be listed on the website.
I'm looking forward to doing that, just that.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and this is not, you weren't given the best territory this morning for fishing. You've kind of come up with zero so far.
Zero so far for the week, but it's only Monday, so.
Well, thanks so much.
Absolutely, thank you.
Welcome.